You're now tuned in to Cognitive Flow, brought to you by OptimalAnesthesia.com, where clinical insight meets focused clarity. Welcome back, everyone. Today, we're really getting into the weeds, doing a deep technical dive into a system that honestly dictates so much of our day-to-day in the OR. That's the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system, you know, the RAAS.
Right. And maybe let's forget the dry textbook definition for a second.
Yeah, exactly. Think of it more like the body's hidden hydraulic control system. It's this incredibly complex, resilient neurohormonal network and its whole job, defending arterial pressure, volume, electrolytes, constantly.
And that's the critical part, isn't it? This super sensitive defense system. We as anesthesiologists fundamentally disrupt it.
Yeah.
Every single time we induce a patient.
We really do.
Think about it. We give agents that hammer sympathetic tone.
Yeah.
We use volatile agents. They cause vasodilation. We start mechanical ventilation. That itself messes with renal perfusion pressure. It's like the system's built for endurance,
yeah,
and we just throw it into chaos.
So our mission today is, well, it's pretty ambitious. We need to connect the dots between the tiny molecular details, the plumbing of the RAS, and what we actually do at the bedside, high-stakes clinical practice.
Mm-hmm.
We want you to really internalize this Poe idea, predict, prevent, and personalize how you manage hemodynamics. And that comes from understanding the patient's underlying RAS tone before you even start.
Because the stakes are just huge. I mean, think about that patient who's been suppressing this system for years. Maybe they're on an ACE inhibitor like lisinopril or an ARB like losartan.
Right.
They've essentially switched off their main non-adrenergic way to vasoconstrict. Mm. So you give a standard dose of propofol.
And the pressure just tanks.
Exactly. Plummets. And suddenly you're staring down this vasoplegia that just doesn't respond to your usual go-to pressors, your catecholamines. It's chilling, actually. We have to understand why that happens before it happens.
Yeah, that blood pressure drop isn't just about how many milligrams of propofol you pushed. It's about the underlying molecular state, the exhaustion of that RAIS system. So, okay, let's get under the hood. Let's look at the engine itself.
Okay, so the whole cascade kicks off with a sensor. It's in the kidney called the juxtaglomerular apparatus, the JGA. Think of it as this incredibly smart monitoring station.
Right.
And it uses basically three main signals to decide, okay, do I need to release renin? Renin is like the starting gun for the whole RAAS response.
So what are those three signals? What triggers the renin release?
Well, the first one is purely mechanical. It's the intrarenal baroreceptors. Mm-hmm. They're right there in the wall of the afferent arteriole, the little artery feeding the glomerulus.
Okay.
They literally feel the stretch. So if your systemic blood pressure drops and that vessel wall stretches less, usually when the MAP dips below about 90 millimeters of mercury, boom, renin gets released. It's the kidney's own pressure alarm.
Makes sense. And pathway number two involves the nervous system, right? The sympathetic system we're always dealing with.
You got it. Sympathetic nerves actually run directly to these JGA cells. So any kind of stress, surgical stress, losing volume, even just, you know, pre-op anxiety, it drives up that central sympathetic outflow.
Okay.
That signal hits beta 1 adrenergic receptors on the JGA cells. Activation there ramps up intracellular cyclic AMP, CAMP, which then triggers PKA signaling.
Yeah.
And the result is a big boost in renin release.
So mechanical pressure, nerve signals. What's the third sensor you mentioned? It brings in the chemical side?
Precisely. That's the macula densa. It's this specialized patch of cells. It sits right where the distal tubule kind of loops back near the glomerulus. Its job is to taste the fluid going by, specifically the salt concentration, NaCl.
Ah, check in the saltiness.
Exactly. So if fluid flow is slow, meaning maybe systemic volume is low,
yeah,
and lots of salt has been reabsorbed earlier, the macula densa senses a drop in that distal NaCl concentration. And that triggers the release of local signals, mainly prostaglandin E2, PGE.
Mm.
PGE then acts on the granular cells, stimulating more renin release. So you've got mechanical, neural, and chemical inputs all telling the kidney, hey, pressure or flow is low. Release renin.
That sounds like a really robust system, almost fail-safe. But then our anesthetic drugs come along.
Yeah. They're remarkably good at disabling this early warning system. It's almost systematic. Take the induction agents, propofol, thiopental, even etomidate to some extent. They work centrally.
Right, in the brainstem.
They suppress those vasomotor centers, basically crushing sympathetic outflow. And by doing that, they specifically cut off that crucial beta-1 signal that the JGA needs for for a fast renin response.
Okay, so induction knocks out the central signal, and then we add the volatile agents on top of that.
And add insult to injury, yeah.
Well,
volatile anesthetics, especially things like sevoflurane, isoflurane, they don't just further reduce renal sympathetic activity. They seem to directly interfere with making CAMP inside the JGA cells.
Yep.
So we're basically giving this cocktail that knocks out the main stimulus and messes with the local machinery needed to release the defense hormone. It's a double hit.
It's a profound systemic shutdown, really. It's probably worth contrasting that with agents that don't do this or even do the opposite.
Good point. Look at ketamine. Mm-hmm. It's known for its sympathomimetic effects, right? It causes norepinephrine release. That often leads to a rise, albeit transient, in plasma renin and angiotensin II. That's partly why it holds blood pressure up better in shocky patients.
Right.
But then you have dexmedetomidine. It's an alpha-2 agonist. It suppresses central norepinephrine release, so it inhibits that sympathetic drive to the JGA, leading to less renin. That can actually worsen hypotension, especially if the patient's already borderline.
So the really critical takeaway here for everyone listening is that our standard volatile anesthetic technique, it blunts that very first crucial wave of compensatory renin release. And if your patient is already dependent on a fragile RAAS, maybe they have chronic heart failure, or they're on those blockers, that blunted response. That's why they get that profound, early, sometimes really scary hypotension right after induction.
Okay, so renin's out in the bloodstream now. It finds its target, angiotensinogen. This is a big protein just floating around, made constantly by the liver.
Right.
Renin snips off a piece of angiotensinogen, turning it into the inactive form, angiotensin III. It's a 10 amino acid peptide. Doesn't do much yet.
And then the magic happens, mostly in the lungs, right? Converting it to the active form.
Mostly, yeah. The conversion happens on endothelial cells pretty much everywhere.
Yeah.
The lungs have a massive surface area, so that's where most of it occurs. The enzyme doing the work is angiotensin converting enzyme, or ACE.
ACE.
It sits right there on the surface of those endothelial cells. Grabs angiotensin the first, snips off two more amino acids, and boom, you get the highly active 8 amino acid peptide, angiotensin the second, ANG2. That's the body's heavyweight champion of vasoconstriction, the main player in this whole system.
Okay, and this brings us smack into this idea of ACE duality. This is so critical for understanding why ACE inhibitors cause the problems they do. We know ACE makes ANG2 the squeezer, but what's its other job?
Yeah, this is where it gets interesting. ACE has another name, kinase the second, because its second crucial function is to break down and inactivate bradykinin.
Bradykinin, the vasodilator.
Exactly. A potent vasodilator, also involved in inflammation and pain. It comes from a totally different system, the kallikrein-Kinin system. But ACE is the cleanup crew for bradykinin.
So, wait, when we give an ACE inhibitor, like ramipril, we're not just stopping the production of ANG2, the vasoconstrictor.
No, you're simultaneously preventing the breakdown of bradykinin, the vasodilator.
Wow. Okay, so that's the implication for patients on chronic therapy.
That's it. ACE inhibitors cause vasodilation through two powerful mechanisms happening at the same time. You reduce the squeeze from ANG2 and you amplify the relaxation from bradykinin. It's a double hit. And that explains why these patients can get such exaggerated, really enhanced hypotension when we induce anesthesia.
And this dual action, this also connects to that rare but really feared side effect, angioedema, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. The thinking is that the buildup of bradykinin, because ACE isn't there to clear it, is the main culprit behind ACE inhibitor-induced angioedema. Bradykinin hits its own receptors, increases vascular permeability, causes local swelling, sometimes massive swelling in the airways. It's a crucial point. ACE sits at the crossroads of two opposing systems. Block it, and you tip the balance hard towards vasodilation. Okay, so angiotensin II is made. Now it needs to find its targets. It does this mainly through two receptor types, ATO and ATRO. So you can kind of think of them as siblings with totally opposite personalities.
All right, let's start with the main one for pressure, right? The ATO receptor, ATO. The constructor, you called it in the outline, the one doing the squeezing.
Exactly. ATO is everywhere, vascular, smooth muscle, adrenal glands, kidneys, brain. Mechanistically, it's tied to a GQ protein. So ANG2 binds, activates GQ.
And that kicks off the PLC pathway.
Yep. GQ activates phospholipase C, PLC. PLC then chops up a membrane lipid, PIP, into two messengers, IP and DAG-A. IP is the big one here. It travels to the cell's calcium store, the sarcoplasmic reticulum, and triggers a massive release of calcium into the cell's cytoplasm.
And that flood of calcium, that's the molecular switch for muscle contraction.
That's the fundamental trigger. That rise in intracellular calcium activates myosin light chain kinase, which lets the actin and myosin filament slide and the muscle cell contracts. Vasoconstriction.
Got it.
And ATR does more than just squeeze vessels directly. It also boosts sympathetic signals from the brain, tells the adrenal gland to make aldosterone. We'll get to that. And long term, it drives nasty stuff like vessel thickening and fibrosis.
Okay, so that's the powerful constructor. Now contrast that with its sibling, the ATR receptor, ATR, the relaxer.
Right. The ATR is a counterbalance. It's generally less abundant in adult blood vessels, but its effects are mostly the opposite. Vasodilation, anti-growth, anti-fibrosis. It's mainly coupled to G proteins.
G, okay. Different pathway.
Different pathway. Giant activation leads down cascades that actually boost bradykinin signaling and, importantly, activate endothelial nitric oxide synthase, ENOs.
ENOs, nitric oxide, NO.
Makes lots of NO. And NO then diffuses into the smooth muscle cell, activates another enzyme, soluble glandulase cyclase, which makes cyclic GMP CGMP.
And CGMP is the universal signal for relaxation, basically.
It is. CGMP promotes relaxation, lowers calcium sensitivity. So here's the absolutely critical clinical point, the aha moment, if you will.
Okay.
In patients who are taking an ACE inhibitor or an ARB, that powerful vasoconstrictive ATR signal, it's gone. It's blocked.
Right.
Which means the opposing signals, the ones coming from the ATR pathway, become dominant. They're unopposed now.
Whoa. So we don't just lose the main squeeze signal. We actually amplify the relaxed signal that's still there.
You got it. That ATR dominance driving NO and CGMP production, it fundamentally shifts the whole vascular set point towards vasodilation and towards resistance to other pressors, like catecholamines. This is the biochemical reason, deep down, why these patients can get so profoundly hypotensive and resistant to norepinephrine during anesthesia. The balance is just completely tilted.
Okay, let's talk about aldosterone. It's kind of the end product of this whole RAAS cascade. We often think of it as the slow actor, mainly dealing with volume long term. Let's start there with its classical genomic action.
Yeah, the classical action is definitely slow, and it's all about holding on to salt and water. Aldosterone is a steroid hormone, so it slips right into the kidney cells, specifically the principal cells in the collecting duct.
Okay.
Inside, it binds to its receptor, the mineralocorticoid receptor, MCRR8. This whole complex then travels into the nucleus and basically acts like a switch on the DNA. It turns on genes to make new proteins.
And the key proteins are?
The main ones are the epithelial sodium channel, ENaC, which gets inserted into the side of the cell facing the urine, and the sodium-potassium ATPase pump, the NOTCO pump, on the other side, facing the blood.
And making new proteins takes time, right? Transcription, translation?
Absolutely. That's why the effect is slow. You start seeing sodium reabsorption and water following it maybe 30 to 60 minutes after aldosterone levels rise, but it really peaks hours later. So while it's vital for keeping your overall volume stable long term,
it's not doing much for you in that first 5 minutes after induction when the pressure is crashing.
Exactly. It offers basically zero help for that acute pressure drop.
You mentioned there's also a non-genomic rapid action, something happening much faster.
Yeah, this is relatively newer thinking, but it seems aldosterone can also act much faster, within seconds to minutes. It does this through receptors located right on the cell membrane, not inside the cell, especially on endothelial cells and vascular smooth muscle cells.
Okay, membrane receptors, what do they do?
Binding there seems to activate quicker signaling pathways, like PKC and MAPK cascades. These can rapidly modify existing proteins, like ion channels. And that seems to increase the contractility of the vascular smooth muscle a bit. It's probably a minor effect compared to Ang-2, but it is fast.
Interesting. Still, clinically, we're mostly concerned about aldosterone's effects on electrolytes, especially potassium, right? What are the big electrolyte risks we need to watch for?
Huge risks, yeah. Especially with potassium, Kai. If you have hyperaldosteronism, maybe from a tumor, or more commonly secondary to something like heart failure, the kidney wastes a lot of potassium. You get hypokalemia, low potassium, often below 3.5.
And low potassium is bad because?
Increases risk of arrhythmias, makes the heart irritable. And really relevant for us, it prolongs the action of our non-depolarizing muscle relaxants like rocuronium.
Okay.
Makes wake-ups trickier.
Okay. And the flip side, too little aldosterone.
Hypoaldosteronism, maybe from kidney disease. Or drugs like spironolactone, which blocks the MR receptor, or even just the combo of an ACEIARB with a potassium-sparing diuretic.
Mm-hmm.
That leads to the opposite problem, hyperkalemia. Hypotassium.
And hypotassium is really dangerous.
Extremely dangerous, especially if COG gets above 5.5 or so. It's a cardiac depressant, slows conduction, and it's an absolute contraindication to using succinylcholine. Giving succus to a hyperkalemic patient can cause a massive, potentially fatal release of potassium, leading to cardiac arrest. So checking and correcting potassium pre-op in patients at risk, absolutely non-negotiable.
Okay, let's broaden the view a bit. The RAAS doesn't operate in a vacuum, right? It talks to other systems. Tell us about the link between angiotensin II and the vasopressin, also known as ADH.
Yeah, they're tightly integrated. Angiotensin II, whether it's circulating in the blood or actually made right there in the brain, directly stimulates AT uroreceptors that are located in the hypothalamus.
Okay, in the brain.
Right. And stimulating those hypothalamic AT receptors tells the pituitary gland, specifically the posterior pituitary, to release vasopressin. It's really elegant, actually. Your body senses low pressure or volume, and it triggers both Ang-2 for vasoconstriction and vasopressin for water retention. Integrated response.
That integration is interesting, but for us in anesthesia, the real magic of vasopressin comes when the RAAS system itself fails, right? Why is vasopressin often the go-to drug for that ACEI or ARD-induced vasoplegia? Why is it the backup system?
It boils down to molecular independence. Vasopressin acts mainly on VOAD receptors on vascular smooth muscle. Now, here's the key. V receptors are also GQ coupled, just like the AT receptors we talked about earlier.
Okay, same coupling protein, GQ.
Same coupling protein, which means they use the exact same downstream pathway to cause contraction.
Yeah.
GQ activates PLC, makes IPOs, releases calcium. Squeeze.
So it uses the same final mechanism inside the cell to make the muscle contract?
Precisely. But, and this is the crucial difference, the V-O-receptor pathway is completely independent of the angiotensin II pathway upstream. And it's also independent of the adrenergic system, the norepinephrine pathway.
Ah.
So if your sympathetic system is knocked out by anesthesia, or if the AT-uroreceptor is blocked by that ARB the patient took,
yeah,
the VRO-receptor pathway, it's still fully functional. It's untouched. It can still trigger that calcium release and get the vessel to constrict.
So it's like the main power grid, RAA sympathetic, is down because of the drug, but vasopressin plugs into an independent generator, the VRO-receptor, that still works using the same GQ wiring inside the house.
That's a great analogy. Yes.
Yeah.
It bypasses the pharmacological roadblock. And that's why we need to think about reaching for vasopressin relatively early in those refractory cases. We're not just adding more pressor. We're switching to a fundamentally different, uncompromised signaling system. #tag 2.2 oxidative stress and endothelial dysfunction. Now, controlling vessel tone isn't just about calcium and contraction. It's also about the health of the inner lining of the blood vessel, the endothelium. There's this constant battle going on there between things that relax the vessel, mainly nitric oxide, NO, and things that damage it, called reactive oxygen species, ROS.
Right, oxidative stress. And angiotensin II, unfortunately, seems to be on the wrong side of that battle. It promotes damage.
It's a major player in driving oxidative stress.
Yeah.
When Ang-2 binds to its AT uroreceptor, one of the things it does is activate these enzymes in the cell membrane called NADPH oxidases.
Okay.
Activating NADPH oxidase is like setting off a molecular bonfire. It generates huge amounts of reactive oxygen species, ROS, particularly superoxide anions.
And superoxide is bad news because it directly attacks that good guy, nitric oxide.
Exactly. Superoxide is highly reactive. And it just loves to gobble up NO. It scavenges it almost instantly. When they combine, they form something even nastier called peroxynitrite, which is a really potent oxidant.
So the Ang-2 signal basically destroys the vessel's own natural relaxation mechanism.
It depletes the vessel of its protective NO, triggers inflammation, and over time promotes actual physical damage and remodeling of the vessel wall. So the AT-uroreceptor doesn't just squeeze the vessel via calcium. It also systematically degrades the relaxation pathway, making the vasoconstriction worse in the long run.
Wow. So the clinical result of all this chronic Ang-2-driven ROS production is what we call endothelial dysfunction.
That's it. Widespread endothelial dysfunction. And clinically, how does that show up? Well, you see patients with really labile blood pressure. You might see kidneys that can't regulate their own blood flow properly anymore, even if systemic pressure seems okay. And ultimately, it contributes to catecholamine resistance. The smooth muscle cell itself might be okay, but the environment around it is so inflamed and lacking NO that it just doesn't respond properly when norepinephrine shows up.
Does our choice of anesthetic affect this ROS-NO balance at all?
Interestingly, it seems volatile agents like sevoflurane might have a small, maybe protective effect here. While they cause vasodilation overall, some evidence suggests they might slightly inhibit that NADPH oxidase activity.
Huh.
So by reducing ROS production a little bit, they might help preserve some NO signaling. It's complex, but it could contribute partly to why they cause vasodilation.
Okay, let's put all this molecular stuff into a real-time clinical scenario. Picture that high-risk patient, maybe they didn't hold their ARB like they were supposed to. We induce them. What does that hemodynamic collapse look like on the monitor, minute by minute?
It often follows a pretty distinct timeline. First, 0 to 2 minutes after induction. That's the immediate drop, mostly due to the induction agent itself. Propofol, causing venodilation, suppressing sympathetic tone, that's kind of nonspecific, happens to some extent in many patients. Then comes the critical window, 2 to 5 minutes. This is when the body should be fighting back, launching that sympathetic response, kicking out renin. But if the RAAS is blocked or the sympathetic drive is crushed by the anesthetic, that compensation just doesn't happen, or it's incredibly weak,
It's blunted.
massively blunted. So by 5 to 10 minutes, because there was no effective fight back, that initial hypotension becomes sustained, it deepens, and it starts to transition into that state we dread, catecholamine-resistant vasoplegia. Now it's being driven by that unopposed AT uroreceptor, the NO pathway, just keeping things relaxed.
The fact that it follows that kind of timeline, that's exactly why we can and should use that PL framework you mentioned earlier, predict, prevent, personalize.
Exactly. Predict means doing your homework. Scour that pre-op chart. Who's high risk? Anyone on chronic ACEIs or ARBs, obviously. Patients with known CHF, chronic heart failure, end-stage kidney disease, CKD. Maybe someone with cirrhosis or sepsis who already has a low SVR baseline. You need to flag these patients mentally.
Okay, predict the risk, then prevent. This seems to boil down mainly to managing those RAAS blockers, right? You mentioned holding them. Can we get specific about why 24 hours for ACEIs and 36 for ARBs?
Yeah, the timing relates directly to the drug pharmacokinetics, their half-lives. Many ACEIs, like lisinopril or the active form of rampicril, have really long half-lives. We're talking 12, maybe 17 hours, or even longer for some metabolites. ARBs like losartan or valsartan can also hang around a long time.
So you need enough time for the drug levels to actually drop significantly.
You need to wait roughly 1.5 to 2 half-lives to get the plasma concentration down enough so the receptors can start functioning again. The clinical data we have suggests that holding ACEIs for about 24 hours and ARBs for maybe 36 hours significantly cuts down the risk, maybe by 35-40% of that severe refractory hypotension right after induction. It's probably the single most impactful preventative step I can take.
Okay, that's crucial. Predict, prevent, and then personalize the treatment if hypotension still happens, which means choosing the right pressor based on the underlying problem. We'll get into the details of that algorithm soon. #check3.2, defining catecholamine-resistant vasoplegia.
So let's nail down what we actually mean by this term. We need a working definition. Catecholamine-resistant vasoplegia is basically persistent low blood pressure, let's say a mean arterial pressure, MAP, consistently under 65 mmHg, combined with a low systemic vascular resistance, SVR. Usually, if you're measuring it, is less than 800 Dyne-Sicamen. And this is happening despite the fact that you've made sure the patient has enough fluid volume and their heart is pumping okay, adequate cardiac output.
And the key part is the resistance.
And the key part is that it's not responding well to your standard catecholamine pressors, like norepinephrine. You're cranking up the norepinephrine maybe above 0.1 or 0.2 mics per kilo per minute, and the pressure just isn't coming up reliably. That's vasoplegia.
So let's quickly synthesize the molecular basis of that resistance. Why doesn't the norepinephrine work well? Let's tie together what we've discussed.
It's really a multi-pronged failure at the molecular level. First, you've lost the direct squeeze signal. The ATU receptor is blocked, so you don't get that GQ-driven calcium release that Ang-2 normally provides. That's strike one. Second, you have active relaxation happening. The unopposed ATU receptor and maybe bradymichinin are driving up NO and cGMP, actively pushing the vessel towards dilation. Strike two.
Fighting against you.
And third, you have adrenergic desensitization. Ang-2 normally helps sensitize the alpha-1 receptors that norepinephrine binds to. Without Ang-2 around, those alpha-1 receptors are just less responsive. It's like the doorbell norepinephrine's ringing, but the person inside the receptor is less likely to answer because their usual partner, Ang-2, isn't there. Strike three.
So, yeah, you're pushing a drug onto a receptor that's partially deaf in a vessel that's actively trying to relax because of NO excess. No wonder it doesn't work well. What are the quick clinical clues at the bedside? Besides the monitor just reading low, what might you see or feel?
Often the patient will look paradoxically well-perfused peripherally. They might be warm, flushed, maybe even have bounding pulses despite the low MAP. That's because of massive vasodilation in the skin and non-essential beds. If you have an arterial line in, the waveform itself can give clues. You'll often see a low diastolic pressure and maybe a narrow pulse pressure, which points toward that low SVR. But most telling sign is often the response to a bolus. You give a shot of norepinephrine or phenylephrine.
Pressure comes up for a second.
Exactly. Comes up briefly, maybe 30 seconds a minute, and then it just slides right back down to where it was. That tells you the underlying receptor system is just too compromised to sustain the response. That's a big red flag for vasoplegia. Time to stop flogging the Neo and think differently.
Okay, so we know the RAAS is sensitive to its own blockers, the ACEIs and ARBs, but it also gets tripped up by other common drugs we might use or that patients might be taking. Let's flag some key pharmacologic traps. What about NSAIs?
Oh, NSAIs are a huge one, especially for kidney function. Ibuprofen, naproxen, ketorolac. They work by blocking cyclooxygenase COX enzymes.
Right, which make prostaglandins?
Exactly. And certain prostaglandins, like PGE and PGRS, are absolutely vital for the kidney. They do two main things. They help keep the afferent arteriole, the inflow pipe to the glomerulus, dilated, which maintains blood flow to the kidney, especially when systemic pressure is low. And remember PGROs. It also helps stimulate renin release from the JGA.
Ah!
So NSAIDs block both the kidney's ability to protect its own blood flow and its ability to kickstart the RAAS.
Precisely. So if you give an NSAID, especially to someone who's already volume down or has underlying kidney issues, and then their pressure drops during anesthesia, the kidney can't protect itself. It can't dilate that afferent arteriole, and it can't trigger renin release effectively. That's a direct path to acute kidney injury, AKI.
Okay, big warning sign there. Yeah. And we have to keep hammering on the ACI SARBs themselves.
Absolutely. The risk isn't just the initial hypotension. It's the subsequent non-response to our usual treatments. The rule really has to be hold ACIs 24 hours. ARBs 36 hours before elective surgery, unless there's an extremely compelling reason not to, like incredibly severe heart failure where stopping is deemed riskier. But that should be a conscious, documented decision.
Got it. And you mentioned dexmedetomidine earlier, which is interesting because we sometimes use it thinking it might be smoother hemodynamically.
Right. But mechanistically, dexmedetomidine is a potent alpha-2 agonist. It works centrally to decrease sympathetic outflow. And remember, sympathetic drive is one of the key triggers for renin release.
So dex suppresses renin.
It suppresses renin. So if you have a patient who's already kind of dependent on their baseline RAAS tone and you add dex on top of, say, propofol, which also suppresses sympathetic tone, you're hitting that renin trigger from multiple angles.
Yeah.
It can definitely compound the hypotensive risk rather than mitigate it sometimes.
Okay, now let's talk about the real nightmare scenario, the triple whammy. This combination of drugs can be absolutely devastating for the kidneys. Let's break down why the combo of an NSAA plus an ACEI or ARB plus a diuretic is so dangerous step by step.
It truly is the perfect storm for inducing AKI. Let's walk through it. First, the diuretic. Its job is to make you lose salt and water, right? So that causes volume depletion. Low volume is the primary signal that should be turning on the RAAS.
Okay, so the alarm bell, low volume, is ringing.
Right. But then the patient's also taking an ACEI or ARB. What does that do? It blocks the RAAS response. Specifically, it blocks angiotensin II's crucial job of constricting the efferent arteriole, the outflow pipe, from the glomerulus. Normally, Ang2 squeezes that efferent pipe to keep pressure inside the glomerulus high enough for filtration, even if systemic pressure drops. Block Ang2, and you lose that ability to maintain filtration pressure.
So alarm bell ringing, but the main safety mechanism, efferent constriction, is disabled.
Disabled. And then on top of that, the patient takes an NSAI. What does that do? It blocks the prostaglandins that normally dilate the efferent inflow arteriole to maintain blood flow to the glomerulus when pressure is low.
Oh, man. So volume is low, the safety mechanism to keep filtering is broken, and the kidney can't even maintain its own blood supply because the inflow pipe constricts inappropriately.
You nailed it. The kidney is basically getting strangled from all sides. Low inflow, inability to maintain pressure, and the primary rescue system, RAAS, is offline. Even mild intraoperative hypotension in a patient on the triple whammy makes AKI almost inevitable. We have to recognize and avoid this combination perioperatively whenever possible. #tag 4.2 disease-specific phenotypes.
This really underscores why understanding the patient's background is so vital. Chronic diseases dramatically change how the RAAS behaves. Let's explore a few distinct disease-specific phenotypes. How does chronic hypertension change things?
the stiff pipes analogy.
In many patients with chronic hypertension, the RAAS, especially Ang-2, has been chronically elevated or overactive. This doesn't just raise pressure acutely. Over time, it physically remodels the blood vessels. You get thickening of the smooth muscle, more fibrous tissue. The arteries become stiff, less compliant.
Like old plumbing.
Exactly. These patients are often also a bit volume depleted from diuretic use, and their stiff vessels become highly dependent on that baseline Ang-2 tone to maintain pressure.
So clinically, what's the implication for anesthesia?
They're fragile. They might seem resistant to small drops in pressure initially, but when you induce anesthesia and really knock down their sympathetic tone, their pressure can fall off a cliff because that underlying Ang-2 support structure was so critical. The key is maintaining their MAP very close to their usual baseline. Often that 20% rule is crucial because their organs are used to higher pressures and dropping too low risks hypoperfusion injury.
Okay, stiff pipes, tight control. What about CHF or CKD, chronic heart failure or chronic kidney disease, the volume overdrive phenotype?
Here, the RAAS activation is often described as maladaptive. The body, especially in heart failure, senses low effective circulating volume or low cardiac output, even if total body volume is high. It misinterprets this as needing more volume and pressure.
So it cranks up the RAAS inappropriately.
Constantly. High levels of Ang-2, high levels of aldosterone. This leads to chronic vasoconstriction, high SVR, salt and water retention, worsening the volume overload. But the system is also working overtime, so the receptors, the ATA receptors, might actually be somewhat fatigued or downregulated from chronic overstimulation.
Right, hyperactive but potentially exhausted. So what's the pressor logic when these patients get hypotensive?
It's tricky. They're at risk of volume overload, obviously, but they might also respond poorly to standard catecholamines because of that potential ATA receptor downregulation. Given that the Ang-2 pathway might be stressed or less responsive, vasopressin often becomes a very good choice here. It bypasses the potentially fatigued Ang-2 system entirely and hits those fresh ERO receptors.
Makes sense. Okay, now for the really dramatic state, sepsis, the exhausted RAAS phenotype. What's happening molecularly here? This seems different again.
Very different. Sepsis involves a massive inflammatory response, a cytokine storm. These cytokines do a couple of really bad things to vascular control. First, they cause a widespread downregulation, meaning fewer receptors, and also functional desensitization, meaning the receptors that are left don't work as well as the AT receptors.
Okay, so Ang-2 has fewer places to work, and they don't listen well.
Exactly. And second, those same cytokines trigger the production of a different kind of nitric oxide synthase called inducible NOS, or iNOS, especially in immune cells and vascular cells. Unlike the normal eNOS that makes NO carefully, iNOS just churns out massive, overwhelming amounts of NO constantly.
Just flooding the system with relaxed.
Flooding it. And it's this combination, poorly responsive ATU receptors and a massive flood of NO that drives the profound hallmark vasodilation and catecholamine resistance we see in septic shock. The vessels are both unresponsive to constriction and actively being pushed into relaxation.
Which logically leads to why angiotensin, the second infusion itself, can be a rescue therapy in sepsis.
Precisely. Giving exogenous angiotensin the second infusion is now a recognized strategy for refractory septic shock. It works not because the patient's own RAAS is suddenly fixed, but because you're providing such high superphysiological levels of ANTR that you basically force the few remaining somewhat functional ATR receptors to respond, helping to overcome that downregulation and fight back against the NO deluge.
Fascinating. Okay, one more phenotype. Cirrhosis. Liver failure patients. What's their RAAS picture?
Cirrhosis is unique. They have this weird combination. Because of portal hypertension and systemic inflammation, they get massive dilation in their splanchnic circulation, the duct vessels, and often have high systemic NO levels, leading to a very low overall SVR, similar in some ways to sepsis.
Low resistance.
Low resistance systemically. But at the same time, because the failing liver isn't clearing hormones properly, and because of the low effective arterial volume, they often develop secondary hyperaldosteronism, very high aldosterone levels, leading to sodium retention, ascites, edema. So low SVR, but high total body fluid.
What's the pressor approach there?
Because the systemic vasodilation is often heavily driven by NO, and because the splanchnic bed is so dilated, drugs that target the VO receptor are often very effective. Tilapressin, a vasopressin analog, or vasopressin itself, are commonly used. They seem to preferentially constrict that dilated splanchnic bed and are effective against the NO-mediated vasodilation.
Wow. So the big clinical pearl here really is, RAAS physiology dictates your pressor logic. You absolutely have to think about why the patient is hypotensive at a molecular level. Is the system blocked? Is it exhausted? Is it overwhelmed by NO? Answering that tells you which pressor is most likely to work. Okay, let's bring this all together into actionable management. We know prevention is key. We've talked about holding the RAAS blockers. That seems paramount. What other specific actionable steps should we be taking preoperatively?
All right, holding the meds is step one. ACEIs, 24 hours, ARBs, 36 hours documented, confirm the patient actually did it. Step two, check and correct electrolytes, especially potassium. We talked about the risks of hyper and hypokalemia. If that KO is significantly out of whack, say outside 3.0 to 5.5 millimol, seriously consider delaying elective surgery until it's corrected. The risks are just too high.
Okay, meds held, potassium checked. What about fluids? If we hold the blockers, they might be a bit dry, right?
They might be, or at least relatively volume depleted compared to their usual state on the drug. So step three is proactive hydration, but cautiously. You don't want to fluid overload them either, especially if they have underlying heart issues. A moderate preload seems reasonable. Maybe 5 to 7 milliligrams of balanced crystalloid given before induction can help buffer that initial vasodilatory hit.
You specifically said balanced crystalloid. This brings up the fluid choice debate. Why is that important here? Why are things like Ringer's lactate or plasmolite potentially better than good old normal saline in these patients?
This is actually a really important physiological point. Normal saline, 0.9% ACL, contains a lot of chloride, much more than plasma. Giving large volumes can cause hyperchloremic metabolic acidosis.
Right, we know that.
But here's the RAAS connection. High chloride levels delivered to the kidney, specifically to the macula densa, are interpreted as a signal that there's plenty of salt and volume around. That high chloride signal actively suppresses renin release.
Whoa. So using normal saline in a high-risk patient could actually turn off the body's own remaining compensatory RAAS response.
Exactly. On top of the fact that large volumes of NAS are increasingly linked to increased risk of AKI anyway, in this specific context, it's pharmacologically working against you by inhibiting renin. Balanced crystalloids like LR or plasmolite have a more physiological chloride concentration. They don't send that suppressive signal to the macula densa. They're essentially RAAS neutral or even slightly supportive and generally preferred, especially if you're giving more than just a small bolus. #TankTag 5.2 intraoperative vasopressor algorithm.
Okay, so we've done our best pre-op, but despite that, the patient becomes hypotensive after induction and it looks refractory. We need a clear, step-by-step intraoperative vasopressor algorithm that moves beyond just cranking up the norepinephrine.
Absolutely. We need to escalate logically based on the molecular targets. Step one, always confirm volume status first. Are they dry? Use dynamic measures if you can pulse pressure variation, PPV, stroke volume variation, SVV. If they need volume, give it. If volume seems adequate, then move to pressors.
Okay. Volume's adequate. Step two.
Step two. Start with your workhorse alpha beta agonist, usually norepinephrine. Titrate it up. Maybe set a reasonable upper limit in your mind, say around 0.2 mixamine. If you're reaching that dose and still not achieving your MAP goal, it's time to think about adding something else, not just pushing the NEO higher and higher.
Right. So if norepinephrine isn't cutting it, step three is the crucial pivot point. Where do we go next?
Step three. This is where you shift systems. Add vasopressin. Start an infusion, typically low dose, 0.01 to maybe 0.04 units per minute. Remember why. You're bypassing the potentially blocked or desensitized adrenergic and ATF pathways and hitting the independent VRO receptor pathway. This is often highly effective in ACEIRUB-induced vasoplegia.
Okay, NEO plus vaso. What if that combination still isn't enough, say, in profound septic shock or really severe vasoplegia? Step four.
Step four. Now you're into rescue adjuncts or direct RAAS support territory. If you suspect massive NO excess is the primary problem, like in sepsis, methylene blue becomes an option.
Methylene blue. How does that work again?
Remember, NO works by stimulating soluble guanyl cyclase, SGC, to make cGMP, the relaxer molecule. Methylene blue inhibits SGC, so it directly reduces the amount of the cGMP being made, counteracting the NO-driven vasodilation. It basically turns down the relaxation signal.
Okay, what other rescues are there?
Hydroxycobalamin injectable vitamin BO is another option some are using. It seems to act as a direct scavenger of NO, mopping it up. And then, of course, there's angiotensin II infusion itself, Chiapreza. This is the most direct approach for states where you think the ATU receptor is the issue, either downregulated or lacking its ligand, like in severe sepsis. You're directly providing the hormone needed to stimulate those receptors.
Got it. And finally, how does our choice of anesthetic agent play into managing these situations intraoperatively?
You want to minimize further hemodynamic insult. Keep volatile agent concentrations low. Use AMEC-sparing techniques if possible. If you're inducing a high-risk patient, consider reducing your propofol dose significantly, or maybe choosing a different induction agent altogether.
Like ketamine.
Ketamine is often a very good choice for induction in these truly high-risk, potentially vasoplegic patients, or those you know continue their RAAS blockers. Its sympathomimetic effects help maintain tone, and it doesn't suppress the RAAS system itself. You can provide a much more stable induction. #tag 5.3 case vignettes for real-world application.
All right, let's make this really concrete. Let's use two quick case examples. Both patients present with refractory hypotension, MEPs stuck in the 40s or 50s despite fluids and escalating norepinephrine. They look similar on the monitor, but the underlying problem is different. Case one, ACEI-induced vasoplegia. Let's say a 68-year-old man takes ramipril daily for hypertension. He says he held it for 24 hours. We prehydrated him moderately. Induction with propofol or acronium, MAP crashes to 45. We start norepinephrine, quickly get up to 0.2 mixgen. Pressure barely budges.
Classic scenario. The molecular lesson here is pharmacological blockade. Even holding ramipril for 24 hours might not have been enough, especially if it was a large dose or he has poor clearance. His AT receptors are effectively silenced by the lingering drug effects, and the unopposed AT receptors, plus maybe some bradykinin, are driving vasodilation. Norepinephrine fails because of that crosstalk failure and receptor desensitization.
So the rescue is...
The rescue here is vasopressin. Start that 0.04 Ouman infusion. The VO receptor provides that essential bypass route. It accesses the GQ pathway independently, mobilizes calcium, and restores vascular tone because that pathway wasn't blocked by the ramipril.
Okay, bypass the block. Now, case two, sepsis vasoplegia. A 75-year-old patient in the ICU with pneumonia, clearly septic shock. They're already on 0.3 mixgen of norepinephrine and 0.04 Ouman of vasopressin just to keep their MAP around 60. SVR measured is super low, maybe 600. They need surgery.
Okay, different pathology. The molecular lesson here is system exhaustion and pathological signaling. Sepsis has caused massive inflammation, ATR receptors are downregulated and desensitized, and there's that overwhelming flood of NO from iNOS. Our standard pressors, NEO and VASO, are working as hard as they can, but they're fighting a losing battle against the sheer force of the septic vasodilation.
So the rescue here isn't bypassing, it's...
Here, the rescue is often angiotensin, the second infusion. You're directly supplying the ligand that the exhausted system needs. By giving supraphysiological doses, you forcefully stimulate whatever ATR receptors are left and functional, hopefully providing enough vasoconstrictive signal to counteract the NO deluge and bring the pressure up.
That's a fantastic illustration. The ultimate synthesis is you had two patients looking almost identical, hemodynamically refractory shock. But understanding the molecular reason for the failure blockade versus exhaustion NO excess led to completely different targeted rescue therapies. One needed a bypass, vaso, the other needed direct system support, ang-2. That's moving from just reacting to the number on the screen to truly personalized, molecularly informed management. #tagltequattro. Wow, that was genuinely a deep dive. We really got into the pulse beneath the anesthetic waveform today. To try and wrap this up, let's come back to that PSHOR framework. Predict, prevent, personalize. The big message seems to be that the RAAS isn't just some obscure kidney thing we learned about once. It's fundamental anesthetic physiology. Every time we induce a patient, every time we titrate a pressor, we are actively interacting with this hormonal circuit board. Understanding its sensitivity, its dual nature, the ATR constructor versus the ATR relaxer, and how it connects with vasopressin.
Yeah.
That's what lets us be proactive, not just reactive.
Absolutely. It's about knowing that ANKR normally drives that ATR squeeze, but also fuels damaging ROS. It's knowing that blocking it with ACEIs or ARBs doesn't just remove the squeeze, it promotes ATR relaxation. That knowledge lets you predict who's at risk and personalize your response. Does this patient need a bypass switch like vasopressin because their ATR pathway is blocked? Or do they need direct molecular support like angiotensin II because the whole system is exhausted or overwhelmed?
Yeah.
Making that distinction based on the underlying molecular flaw. That's how we elevate our practice. We move beyond just chasing the MAP and start practicing truly predictive, mechanism-based hemodynamic control. The RAAS is right there, under the surface, influencing everything. We just need to understand its language.
Couldn't have said it better. A fantastic exploration. Thanks for joining us on today's episode of Optimal Anesthesia. For in-depth notes, visuals, and bonus content, head over to optimalanesthesia.com. Support the learning, support the craft. See you in the next one.